Welcome to the Mind Blown Podcast, where curiosity leads and discoveries follow. I'm Melanie Avalon, biohacker, author, and health influencer. And I'm joined by Scott Immens, entrepreneur, health enthusiast, and seeker of the unknown. Together, we're here to take you on a journey to the very edges of science, technology, philosophy, history, and beyond. Did you know in the minute it takes to introduce this podcast, around 6 million Google searches will be conducted, and at the end of 90 minutes, the space station will have orbited completely around Earth? Did you know when you shuffle a deck of cards, chances are that combination has never been created before? Also, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, time doesn't pass at the same speed for everyone, depending on how fast you're moving. Or how about the idea of quantum superposition? That's that particles can actually be two places at once. So is this actually happening right here, right now? One last fun fact that actually inspired the genesis of this show. If you remember Tinkerbell dotting the I in the Walt Disney logo, that never happened. So on that note, get ready for our adventure on today's Mind Blown Podcast. Welcome back, cognitive connoisseurs, synapse surfers, and epiphany enthusiasts to the Mind Blown Podcast. I'm Melanie Avalon. I'm here with Scott Immens. Scott, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty good today, Melanie. How are you?
I am good. I am excited. This is another episode where I feel like I am just attending because you did the prep on this one. But it is a topic
this is definitely a topic you'll have some familiarity with for sure.
Yes. We did Bob Lazar.
We did Bob Lazar, which would be the closest, I think, to the UFO topic.
I feel like we, because UFOs is just such an obvious topic for this show. I feel like we wanted to build up to it though, you know, so that we could do it justice.
Didn't want to jump out of the gate with UFO. Plus the amount of different kinds of encounters and different sources and vetting it through. It's a lot. So if you really want to, I mean, frankly, you could do it. You could do an episode on each individual incident we'll talk about tonight, which we may do, but it's such a big topic that, yeah, you want to do it right.
Oh, I like that idea. Yeah. If any of the stories seem particularly, you know, good for a standalone, we can create a standalone topic. Okay. Well, before we jump into that, do you have a mind-blowing fact to start us off with?
I do, but I'm going to give you a choice to pick the fact today.
Oh my goodness. I was going to give you a choice.
Were you? Oh, good. I like choices. Okay. So you have a choice between a very realistic robot thing that's happening, fact, or an obscure animal fact.
Well, is the first one going to become obsolete soon?
No.
Let's do the animal.
All right. Have you heard of the tardigrade?
The what?
The tardigrade.
The tardigrade?
T-A-R-D-I-G. R-A-D-E.
Tardigrade.
Tardigrade.
No.
Okay. Well, okay, they are called water bears or moss piglets.
Wait. Pause. Let's pause for a second. Let's reflect. Water bears or moss piglets. Okay, wait. Can I guess? What type of animal this is? Water bear, moss piglet. It literally could be anything. It could be a bug with a cool name, or it could be a mammal.
It's an invertebrate animal and the phylum tardigrade. So that's what it says.
We have any insect people listening, they're probably...
they're freaking out. Yeah. So these amazing little microorganisms have yet to find an environment they can't survive. So they are also known as water bears. They are these eight-legged little creatures. So they look like, if you look at it, it looks like a caterpillar crossed with a teddy bear, except ugly.
Oh, I was going to say, are they cute? Let me look this up.
They're not cute. Here, I got an image I can send you.
Oh, you know what this looks like? Oh, this looks like the Doomsday Machine in Star Trek.
Doomsday Machine.
It does.
I'm not getting that, but I get where you're getting that from.
No. Look up Doomsday Machine. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the vibe for sure.
It's like the Doomsday Machine meets Devil in the Dark creature.
That, I definitely don't remember the Devil in the Dark.
You do not?
No. See, the Doomsday Machine, though, is more hollow, right?
Yes, but it has because Doomsday Machine, it's like this thing with like a mouth that moves towards them. And the pictures of this tardigrade looks like an aggressive, long creature with a mouth. Like all it is a mouth.
Well, the one I'm looking, so that's why we're getting confused. The images that I'm looking at are of all of its mouth is shut. The little tardigrade's mouth is shut. So he looks a lot cuter that way.
Yeah, I'm combining Doomsday Machine meets Devil in the Dark. Do you remember either of these episodes of Star Trek?
Devil in the Dark, I don't recall. I gotta, you know what? It's been so long since I've watched the whole series. I literally have to like go from one all the way to the end again because I gotta have this, you know, on tap. I've never had anyone been able to challenge my Star Trek trivia until you destroyed me.
Yep, that's why I'm here. Devil in the Dark is like there's this cave and there's this like gloppy creature thing. I don't want to give a spoiler because it has a really good ending.
Wait, is that the one where it's like a big hairy, goopy, gloppy thing that's in a cave, like that eats, like swallows people and maybe eats like their energy or something?
Mm-hmm. It does things to people.
Yeah. I remember that thing.
And then Spock mind melds with it and
finds out it's just scared or something.
Should I give the answer away? I don't know.
Well, it's a 40-year-old series. I don't think you're doing a lot of spoiling alert here.
I think they find out that it's like sad. I don't actually remember. I think it's sad about, it's a mom. It's sad about its babies.
Trying to protect its babies and it's scared. Yeah, that's what it was. Mm-hmm.
So I think if we combine this creature with the Doomsday Machine and a caterpillar, then you have the tardigrade.
Yeah, the caterpillar, you're good to go. So if that helps you, we are going to be launching some social media, which will have some of these images. So in the future, you'll be able to follow along with us in lifetime or hopefully close to lifetime as to exactly what these things look like. I took a whole bunch of images for tonight's episode, which was in depth. So the tardigrade, this sucker is crazy though. Are you ready for this thing, what it can do?
Yeah.
It is able to withstand high levels of radiation, going without food or water for over 10 years. It can survive extreme heat of up to 300 degrees or above Fahrenheit and can survive at almost absolute zero. So this thing could basically be like in space for a little while and still live.
Is it microscopic? I can't tell how big it is. How big is it? I think it's tiny.
I do think it's close to microscopic or like in that zone, like microns big.
It looks terrifying.
Could you imagine if that thing was like 20 feet tall?
Yeah, that's really scary. What is it? It's so scary. Oh, it's cute and scary at the same time, which is a weird vibe.
Yeah. If you saw that like on a photo, you're like, oh, it's kind of cute. But if you saw it coming at you, you'd freak out.
Some of the pictures I'm looking at, it's like looking at the camera.
5 millimeters. So not quite microscopic, but, you know, really tiny.
Wow.
Really tiny. They're small and invisible to the naked eye without magnification. So, you know, like the size of a bed bug, which is creepy. I wonder what they eat.
With their little suction mouth thing.
How do they survive? Yeah, it doesn't look like it has much like chompers on it. Looks more like it like just pulls in food through osmosis through its skin.
It looks like an alien. It really does.
It does look like an alien. In fact, it might be an alien. Given the fact that it can live in those extreme temperatures, who knows how it got here?
It looks squishy and robotic and like a caterpillar and like a plush toy and like a vacuum cleaner all combined.
Yeah. So they enter into cryptobiosis, which allows them to like withstand these incredible temperature changes. And then it can dehydrate completely uniformly. So not like you lose, like humans will lose hydration in certain parts of their body before others, kind of prioritizing the brain, etc. Where these guys just go dehydration completely. So
like a sponge.
Yeah, they're just done. Squeeze it out. And that's what prevents them from their cells from exploding when you go -272 degrees and all the cells crystallize and then explode through your skin when you reanimate. It does say that their tiny mass has a huge impact on that. So because they're so tiny, they can survive 6,000 atmosphere levels stronger than current, so they can live in deep ocean trenches. The pressure distributes evenly across their little compact body.
It says they die if they desiccate and then fail to rehydrate properly. Old age, They live a few months to a couple of years. Predators.
So short lives.
Toxic substances, like chemicals.
They're not invincible.
Yeah. They're very resilient for a momentary amount of time.
So there's a lot of different species of these guys, and some eat plant matter. Some eat, they're carnivorous and they eat small invertebrates. Some eat bacteria and microbes. So interesting. They're not like one thing.
Okay. Cool. Well, let me look at it again. The pictures really help add to the mind-blowingness because of what they look like. I'll give it like a 7.5.
7.5. Okay. Yeah, if I'm giving myself a grade, I would give myself an 8 because I think this is so cool that like positive 300 and negative 270, that's nuts. And radiation and dehydration. So kind of crazy, but yeah.
I feel like I need more information, actually, not right now, but to rate it higher, this is what I'm thinking. I'm like, okay, I didn't know this thing existed. There's probably other things like this that microscopic creatures that, you know, I don't know how big the pool is that we're playing in.
The pool of this is pretty small. I won't do it now because it was implied and spoken in your answer, but I don't think there's anything else like this at the microscopic level. But you may recall a fact I delivered many months ago about that eternal jellyfish, which basically just keep like going into dormant stage. Then they like regenerate themselves and then they repopulate and they live for like 3,000 years.
Technically, they can live forever.
Technically, but yeah, there's no, they didn't find an age limit, but I guess there's some kind of way they estimated that. But basically, they're like the never dying animal. That was the closest other thing when I looked up like what's got the most durability, and I did not find any other microscopic critters.
Okay, well, if that's the case, I will up it to an eight.
All right, and I'm just saying I didn't find them, but I didn't also put in like other microscope. Yeah, so yeah, so if you can detract it back to a 7.5 if you were I'd find one before then. Hit me with your fact, Mel. Oh wait, give me the choice. I want a choice.
Yeah, you get choices. Okay, so one involves sex, which I feel like my one last week involved sex. That's why I wanted to give you a choice. Okay. And then the other one involves, this was actually something you would think would mean something, and it just doesn't.
Don't want to hear the sex one, but the meaning that I'm intrigued by is something that would mean something that doesn't. So I'm going to go with option 2, but save that other fact for next week.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so did you know Wi-Fi doesn't stand for anything?
No.
Do you want to know how they picked it? Like, wouldn't you think it stands for something?
Well, there's hi-fi, which is high fidelity. So I'm guessing it comes from hi-fi. And they were like, well, it's like World Wide Web, so we're just going to call it Wi-Fi.
You are so good at figuring these things out. Yeah, it was basically, it's completely made up, and they thought it sounded like hi-fi that people already knew. So they're like, we'll just call it Wi-Fi.
It's kind of a good marketing thing, but I always assumed like there was a little more effort put in. But I also was very familiar with hi-fi because my dad was obsessed with his stereo in the 70s, and that's all we talked about was high fidelity and vacuum tubes versus transistors. So that stuck with me. So that's why it popped in my head. I'm like, I bet you it's got something to do with hi-fi.
That's funny. That was before my time, I think, the focus on hi-fi.
I give it a ridiculous factor of 10.
You're giving it a 10?
No, a ridiculous factor of 10. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, on the ridiculous scale, that's a 10, you know? On the mind-blowing scale?
Wait, let me make my case for why it's so mind-blowing. I think if you were to go up to like everybody on the street and be like, what does Wi-Fi stand for? I don't think one person would be like, oh, it doesn't stand for anything. Everybody would be like, wireless. Like they would think it means something.
I think I would have said my same answer though. I would have said my same answer. I would have been like, I think it's just a derivative of hi-fi and they put it up.
Really?
Yeah, pretty sure. Because I've thought about that a lot, and I've never actually gone to look it up, but I'm always like, Wi-Fi, it's got to be just like World Wide Web, high fidelity thing. That's what they're going for. Anyway, that's what I would. I'm pretty sure that's what I would say. But I doubt, to your point, that the average person would go, "Oh, it's probably a derivative of hi-fi. It's probably wireless fidelity or fiber optic internet." That's probably, yeah, they'd probably come over. So I do agree that the average person would not know what it stood for. But once they found out it, I don't think they'd be like, "Wow, that's crazy."
Oh, see, I think we view mind-blowing facts differently. I consider something super mind-blowing when it's just not what you thought at all. Like, that's when my brain goes, like, I feel little explosions in my brain.
Yes, I think that is a good point, because there is that when your reality is kind of shattered, like, well, wait, what? You mean that means nothing? To you, that's the mind-blowing bigger piece. To me, it's something that's remarkable and makes people go, damn, I can't believe something can do that, or I can't believe.
Yeah, yours is more like things that exist that are mind-blowing, and mine's more like when paradigm shifts, or when I realize I was like wrong about something in reality.
I think that's a good way to put it, and I think that puts a lot in perspective in terms of how we have, I wouldn't say different scales, sometimes different measurements of that. So if I'm going with your scale of like, how mind-blowing is it from a perspective of,
you can use your scale.
Well, I'm gonna use both scales. I'm using your scale of like, it's just like no one knew that, and that's just crazy weird to me,
and it's not what they thought,
and yeah, whatever they think, it's not right. I'd give it a 9 on that scale. On the scale I normally use, which is like, okay, how mind-blowing is that, like a 6.5. so if you average that out, I don't know what that comes to.
I will average it together. Let's see, 6.5 plus 9 divided by 2, a 7.75.
There you go, 7.75.
Excellent. All right, well, that was fun. And we have one more thing before we jump into today's topic. We have this week's winner of my Avalon X Magnesium 8, which I created in partnership with Scott. And friends, this is the best magnesium on the market. It has 8 different forms. It will help so many things in your body, because most people are deficient in magnesium. So it will help your sleep, your energy levels, your muscle recovery, your digestion, all the things. And it comes in a glass bottle, no problematic ingredients, etc. And to enter to win, you just can write a review of the show on Apple Podcasts, and we pick a winner every single week. And so we have this week's winner. So this week's winner, I really like this person. Oh, a girl, I guess. I really like her handle. So her handle is No Thank.
I know who this is.
Oh, you know this person?
It's one of my very close friend's daughter. She's about 12. So her and her dad called me up this weekend, and they said, Maisie is her name. I'll read the review first, then I'll tell you the story.
Okay. I'm glad I didn't do the other fact. Okay.
Yes. Maisie's listening. Hi, Maisie. Thank you for writing the review.
Her handle is No Thank, No Thanks, No. Does that mean something? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm gonna ask her, because I read that too. I'm like, I could just see her though. She's a very confident young woman, so that's probably why she's doing it that way.
Oh, thanks, Maisie. Well, okay, so Maisie, she made the title "Maisie is a new fan!" Exclamation point. And then Maisie said, "Hi, I'm Maisie, and I like the podcast because it was very educational and interesting. Hearing about how dangerous toys can be really helps you be mindful and careful when playing. Oh my goodness. This can help children and adults choose safe toys. Like Scott, my dad also had a set of lawn darts, and I'm glad they are both alive." Oh man, this is the best review ever. Thank you so much, Maisie.
Thank you, Maisie. Yeah, her dad gave me a call. They also listened to the Lizzie Borden episode, which she really liked. And she also had a suggestion for us.
Oh, what was it?
She wants us to do an episode on the most underrated dangerous dogs.
Oh.
Like, which dogs you might not think are dangerous, but are.
Are there a lot of those?
I don't know. I'm going to look into it. She had some other ideas too. I said to that I'd give her a call back, or that she could send an email and we could look through her ideas. But she's super into it, so that was cool.
Yeah, Maisie, send us an email. Well, first of all, send us an email anyway. Although we'll make sure that you get this magnesium.
Oh, she was stoked about the magnesium too, because she goes, "That's going to help me sleep."
Oh, Okay. So Maisie, this is so great. Send us an email, put your name, your address, and definitely give us all of your suggestions. And then Scott and I can read it on the show and we can, you know, talk about some more fun topics to do.
Yes. She had written out an entire page, like a full page review. And she's like, we can't fit it in the little box. I'm like, yes, there's a character limit, Maisie. You're going to have to trim it down.
Well, I love the review, Maisie. It's so great. I really like that you talked about a specific episode because that gets people excited because then they want to go listen to that episode. And I'm glad that you found it, you know, you enjoyed listening and you found it helpful. And I, like you, am glad that your dad and Scott are alive.
We are too.
From the lawn darts, which those were the most dangerous, right? Of all the toys.
Yeah. They actually killed 6 people, like actual deaths. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Well, I'm just smiling. That's awesome. Thank you, Maisie. Hi, friends. If you've been wanting to try my Avalon X Spirulina or are already obsessed like me and want a portable, travel-friendly version, we now have a mini size available. I am so excited about this. I am obsessed with spirulina because it is one of the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet. In fact, it is so nutrient-dense that NASA worked with it to help support the nutrition of the astronauts in space. It is a powerhouse. We're talking a complete vegan protein where a serving contains 625% of your daily vitamin B12. Yes, vegan B12. Over 1500% of your daily vitamin A, 100% of your hard to get vitamin K, and over half of your daily iron. And it's not just that. It also contains potent longevity compounds, things like glutathione, superoxide dismutase, CoQ10, GLA, and so much more. It's almost shocking how incredible spirulina is for your body. So much of our health and longevity involves meeting our nutrient status, and spirulina can help you do that. It supports energy, immunity, even beauty and detox. It took a long time to develop our spirulina because I was obsessive with getting the purest, highest quality spirulina out there. I searched high and low and found the perfect version of spirulina. It comes from the pristine, clean waters of Hawaii, from an extremely environmentally sustainable production facility, and it is purity tested to the max. Not only is it tested by the facility, we third-party tested it for over 70 pesticides, as well as heavy metals and mold. And the new mini version is so cute, so it's an amazing way to try it if you haven't tried it, or if you want to buy a smaller order, or if you want to travel with it, it's the way to go. It comes in beautiful glass bottles to help prevent leaching of plastics into ourselves and the environment. And by the way, it tastes amazing. Yes, I tasted so many different ones. You can get spirulina, including the large bag and this new mini size, at avalonx.us. Use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off. And you can get text updates when you text AvalonX to 877-861-8318. And doing that will get you a one-time 20% off coupon code. You can also get email list updates at avalonx.us/email list. I can't wait for you guys to try this spirulina. Grab the mini version now. Use the coupon code MelanieAvalon for 10% off at avalonx.us. All right, shall we jump into the topic?
Yes, so today's topic is UFOs, but I have broken it into two parts because the first part is going to be military, primarily military. The first one we're going to cover tonight is going to be a combination of military and civilian, which is a very famous, mysterious case with lots of evidence, witnesses, etc. But tonight we'll be primarily on various military encounters at whether it's bases or planes. It'll be about 4 to 7 of those, and then depending on how far we get through, and then we'll do the most famous civilian encounters that have had witnesses, etc.
Awesome. And I have a question. Have you always been team UFO, or what has been your evolution?
I've always been a sci-fi guy. Star Trek since I was a little kid, Battlestar Galactica, you know, Buck Rogers. Anything star, you know, anything science fiction. I was like the first guy in line to watch The Matrix, you know. To this day, I'm still watching sci-fi, so I love it. So UFOs was a huge part of that. I used to watch, I forget the name of the show, but it was like a spoof on Project Blue Book, basically. I think it was called Blue Sky or something like that in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s. So to answer your question, one word, yes. I think I've always been like, they exist, they're out there, I don't know what they are, but they're out there.
Same. Big sci-fi fan. I always just thought it was so, I don't want to sound judgmental, but like, how can you say that you know there's no other life in the universe? Like, have you seen the entire universe? How do you know that? I just thought it was silly. Like people who say, oh, they don't exist, they can't exist. Like, okay. How do you conclude that?
I think when people have that kind of a firm opinion, when there's no evidence either way, except that there's more evidence that something has been here, and there's more of a likelihood that there's some other way or creatures that get here, whether it's through time or whether it's through portals or dimensions or interstellar space, like it just seems way more likely than not. So I do find that funny. And the fact that it was so stigmatized, I mean, even when I was growing up, no one would be like, yeah, I saw a UFO in the 80s or the 90s. Not till like Whitley Strieber's book came out, which was Communion, I think in 88 or 89. In the 90s, people began to talk about it, but you just didn't talk about it because people would think you were a wacko.
Well, the fact that the government even had that press conference where they like made fun of the American public, I just, not cool.
Are you talking about the Phoenix Lights episode?
I'm talking about the one where they held a press conference and the guy from the government dressed up like an alien.
So that's in my second part. That's the civilian encounter. And that was either the governor or the mayor. I think it was the governor. Governor or mayor, I can't remember. Yeah, and he had one of his staff members dress up as an alien and come out. Now, the funny thing is, he saw that UFO.
Yeah, they like admitted it and then they like retracted it.
Well, he got a talking to. See, that's what happened before the press conference was. He got a talking to about, you don't want to scare the public. Let's think about the ramifications of this. So let's just kind of, you know, make it a little lighthearted. And we've got an explanation for you, which is flares, which is freaking hilarious. Because I was watching the Phoenix Lights live on television. It was at 95, I think, 92, something like that. My best friend John and I were watching those Phoenix Lights. And there is no way on God's earth that was flares. You could see triangular crafts, and they weren't like wing triangles. They were just giant triangles, several of them with these giant like lights in each corner. They looked to be the size of a football field, maybe half a football field. And there were dozens of them, and they spanned, like they were floating in the air at super slow speed. Tons of people with VHS cameras, tons of local news people were filming it. Most of that footage is now just lost. It's been, you know, 1984 scrubbed off the internet. But I saw it live, and I know what I saw, and it was not flares.
Well, that's a good teaser for next episode.
Yeah, I was really pissed when that guy did that, because not only did he not address it, I would have been happier if he said, you know what, I can't address this. It's just, we don't have enough information. I'll get back to you. I would have been happier with that than literally making fun of the public. And people were pissed. I mean, he got death threats.
Wow. Okay, so.
So our first encounter, which is a combination of government, actually two governments technically, and civilian. So on November 17th, 1986, a Japanese airliner, Boeing 747. Now that's basically the largest plane you got. Civilian anyway. So this is a massive cargo jet, flight 628. Cruising at an altitude 35,000 feet over eastern Alaska en route to Reykjavik, when the crew spotted this astonishing object directly in front of the plane. So this captain, who was a Japanese captain, this is a Japanese airline, hence JAL, flight 628, if you want to shorthand to Google it, Captain Kenji Tarucha, with his first officer, Takanora Tamafuji, and flight engineer Yasuhiro Tasukura. They first saw three lights directly ahead of the aircraft at 17:11 Alaska time, which I believe in military time is 7:11 a.m. The sky was clear. The jet was speeding at 525 knots, or approximately 600 miles an hour, toward Anchorage, Alaska. It was about 8 miles in front of them. The captain saw three lights flying parallel and then super close to the plane. So now they're like nuzzling up against the plane. And this is his quote. These three lights began to fly parallel and then ... very close. And remember, he doesn't speak English as his first language. But this guy was a decorated war captain in the Japanese army, or war pilot rather, and he had 10,000 hours of flight experience in this 747. So this was no rookie pilot. This guy knows what he's doing. So his quote was, two small ships appeared, and then a mothership appeared next to that. He said, quote, the mothership was twice the size of an aircraft carrier. So what it really seemed like to him was that these two ships were like scouts, and this massive ship behind them was like our Air Force aircraft carriers today. So basically, it had a faint glow. The big one had a faint glow and a rotating beacon on it. And the object said, and they said the crew estimated the two small objects were at least as large as their 747 or bigger.
And then what did they do?
All right. So one of these little guys gets directly in front of them and is right in front of the windshield, but going forward like they're going. So it's going the exact same speed that they're going. Whatever exhaust was coming out was so bright and so hot that the captain and the crew could feel the heat through the airplane's windshield. So he contacts the, you know, the radio tower, and he's like, hey, do you have anything on radar? And they're like, no, we don't have anything on radar. So, but he's got three people that are staring at it. So he knows that this thing is right in front of him. So he's wondering if these lights are like exhaust from another aircraft now. So he's like trying to figure this out. He's trying to come up with any rationale as to what this could possibly be. So he again says, asking again, let's see, turns down the cockpit lights, make sure that he can really see what's going on. He's observed for a few more minutes, and then he contacts air traffic control. So over the next 10 minutes, they gave him evasive maneuver action required. So he does a 360-degree turn and descends the plane down by 10,000 feet and levels off as he's circling. He reported that the lights remained with them on the port wing. And the official transcript notes that during the turn, the UFO maintained its position on the port side and never wavered. In fact, the controller noted that the lights went down with it as it descended. After circling, Teriyaki continued toward Anchorage at about 60 miles north. When he was about 60 miles north of the city, the lights suddenly vanished into the night. Now, meanwhile, on the ground, another plane had taken off. So Anchorage Air Traffic Control brought the U.S. Air Force's Regional Operations Control Center online and asked them to check for military traffic. And the transcript between Anchorage supervisor of air traffic control and the RCC, which is an acronym I don't know, a Regional Operational Control Center for the military, answered, that's an affirmative. We do not have anybody up there right now, quote, end quote. So again, the Anchorage radar controllers did see a faint primary echo about 50 miles south of the plane, which vanished moments later. So they really didn't get a good radar lock on it until after the encounter with the main 747. But he did say when he saw it, he said, this is remarkable. It, quote, it's an unknown, I think, pause, a very, very big plane. And then it disappeared.
And could they only see it from the cockpit? So like the passengers couldn't see it?
So this was a cargo plane. So there were no passengers. However, great question and good segue. Similarly, two other aircraft nearby, United Airlines passenger jet and U.S. Air Force C-130, reported no unusual lights or targets. The C-130 crew explicitly said they saw nothing on radar or visually, and the United crew was sent to look, but they found only the signal of the 747 on approach and saw nothing. But it gets more interesting. I want to say this in the right order. I'll just say it now. So what ends up actually happening, and I'll get into a little more detail, is when the United plane began approaching the cargo plane, this Japanese airliner 747, and the United plane was sent there to look. Oh, by the way, they also asked the captain, the military did, they asked the captain if they wanted a fighter jet to be scrambled to support him. So you know they saw something, or they wouldn't offer him a fighter jet to scramble up there. He declined to have the fighter jet come because he thought that that would antagonize these, what, you know, these UFOs, which were massive. And so he thought the consequences of that could be much more devastating since they weren't seeming to threaten his ship and his plane in any way. But what ends up happening is when the United plane pulls up alongside the cargo plane, the big giant mothership falls down, fades out, and then goes behind both planes underneath them so that neither plane can see them. So it's aware that the people out of the windows could see them, and it's aware that they could see out of the windshields, and it's aware that they can't see them just below and behind them. So it literally nestles itself underneath the two planes and just flies along with them, and they don't know it.
Kind of weird it didn't do that from the beginning.
Well, it didn't seem to have a problem showing itself to the one plane, but I think it didn't want to... I think these things are intelligent enough to know that they were being pinged by military radar at this point, and they didn't want to, I guess, scare the bejesus out of the military and have some kind of encounter.
But it couldn't be picked up on radar at the beginning, right?
No. Anchorage, Alaska air traffic control only got one faint signal, but the military has much more advanced radar.
Oh, okay. So do they think it was like it could deflect some radar?
It was definitely deflecting the civilian radar, but the military can scan into very narrow beams in very narrow therapeutic areas. So if they have a location that they're looking at, and they did because the pilot was reporting it, they can center the beam directly into that area and do a different kind of radar sweep. Whereas airplane radar is literally just like one big kind of scan across the skies versus like honing into a specific area.
Gotcha.
All right. So after landing, the FAA and military analyzed everything. Specialists at the FAA Center in Atlantic City scrutinized the radar records and found that the second target was not another aircraft, but in fact, so after they reviewed, they did see something, right? But not at the time. But an artifact and an uncorrelated primary beacon of the target return from the 747 itself. So they're saying, right, that the FAA is saying, oh, it was just like a glitch from the 747. Meaning the radar was picking up the 747 as two things.
Right. But the pilot, like, saw it.
Right. And they offered to send up a fighter pilot. The FAA noted the controllers had briefly thought that there might be a second plane, but even as they deferred to United Jet, they saw nothing else. The U.S. Air Force likewise checked their data instruments for intermittent radar returns and were logged, but the U.S. FAA spokesman later dismissed that as a random cluster. In March of 1987, the FAA concluded that the incident posed no safety hazard and no further action was required. However, the incident made headlines, captured the imagination of the news media and other UFO enthusiasts. So initial reports were that he was saying his plane was tiny compared to this massive thing and that he had seen a flying saucer, but that's not exactly what he said. He was much more direct. He had the two little glowing things that were more like lights than they were ships, although they did have a structural body, and that the other one was just this massive double end-to-end aircraft carrier, which would be like the size of 3 football fields. By the early 87, the official story had shifted, and Paul Steck told reporters that apparent radar target was an unexplained split image of JL-1628 reversing their earlier suggestion of a split craft. He bluntly noted that the bottom line is that we don't have any radar confirmation of the object the pilot saw. So now they're taking away even like the double image thing. So then all these bizarre, you know, oh, it might have been Jupiter or Mars. Yeah, I mean, this is an experienced fighter pilot with 3 other witnesses who was feeling the heat from it. It's not Jupiter and Mars. You know, it's just the bull crap that they come out with is kind of ridiculous. So investigators start tracing this, and they're trying to come up with, could have been ice crystals that were glowing from the village below. I mean, really? He's 35,000 feet in the air. He's doing a 360-degree spin. Why would they tell him to do a 360-degree spin if they thought it was just a double image or they weren't certain that there was something there? Why would they offer to send a fighter jet up there? Why would they have the United Airlines plane come up alongside him? Like, none of this jives with what they're saying. The pilot was then, so after all this stuff comes out, the Japanese pilot was basically disgraced and put on a desk job, which sucked. The military sources would confirm no other aircraft in the area, blah, blah, blah. However, eventually, what ends up happening is that they do finally get the United States military to admit that there was another object that was behind them and two other objects in front of them. So they finally get that information. They would not release the images, though. They only gave them the information. They would not give them the images from the radar. So basically, he's vindicated. The airline restores his job, but, you know, not after wrecking his name and kind of destroying his life. But that was, again, finally confirmed by military radar. Three, you know, very respectable witnesses, or four, I think, with a pilot who's an experienced fighter pilot with very descriptive information, which then the military radar aligns with. So, crazy.
Wow. What a journey to go through. His Wikipedia page still makes it seem like he made it up, or that it's not real.
Yeah. I wouldn't rely on Wikipedia.
Oh, that wasn't my, I was not trying to say to rely on Wikipedia. I'm saying like.
No, I know you weren't.
Once you get branded there, good luck.
It's really kind of sad in a lot of ways.
One of my sister's best friends from high school, or middle school, high school, she is now a pilot, as is her husband. So cute. They met in the Army? The Air Force? They met somewhere. She was in town and we got drinks. And this was a while ago. But I asked her, I was like, so what are the... Oh, I think I sent you some of the videos from her, maybe. Because I asked her, I was like, what do the pilots think about aliens? She was like, oh yeah, they all see them. Like, it's just like, you know.
Yeah, we all see them. We just don't say shit.
Yeah. And then she literally had like videos from that her husband had taken.
There was a recent, like pretty recent woman who took videos from the cockpit of a plane. I can't remember the story, but it happened just around the time that we were talking about this episode. Or at least I heard about it right around then. But that's cool. I mean, that you have like kind of corroborating evidence that like your direct friends who are pilots are seeing stuff.
I just loved, like, she was so not sensational when she answered. Like, she just made it seem like it was so obvious that all the pilots see stuff all the time.
Almost bored to answer you. Like, yeah, Mel, I mean, come on, Mel, really? Of course we see them.
Okay, friends, I have some mind-blowing and scary facts about your skincare and makeup. Did you know that there's essentially no regulation of skincare and makeup in the US, and that most skincare and makeup products are high in endocrine disruptors, which mess with your hormones? These are compounds which are linked to hormonal disruption, thyroid issues, fertility issues, autoimmune conditions, and even cancer. And they are rampant in our skincare and makeup. That's right. When you're putting on that skincare and makeup to supposedly support your skin and help it look better, you actually could be doing damage to your skin and your body and your health. It is a massive problem today. And ladies, if you're thinking of having children, these compounds actually pass through the placenta into the newborn, setting up our children with a toxic burden from birth. And these compounds can last in our system for years and years. In one study, testing conventional lipsticks, for example, most were found to be high in lead, and the half-life of lead is up to 30 years. That means when you put on some conventional lipstick, 30 years later, maybe half of that lead has left your bones. There's also a legal loophole from the 1960s where companies can put whatever they want in products and don't have to tell you what it is. They just put it under the label fragrance. This is why safe skincare and makeup is so important to me, and I am so passionate about a company called Crunchy. Their standards are impeccable. Crunchy products contain no toxic ingredients, which they define as any ingredient known to cause harm or health hazard based on available ingredient data and research. Each ingredient actually undergoes a 30-step screening criteria for safety. All the products are gluten-free, with third-party lab testing comparable to food standards. A ton of their products are non-GMO, just look for the badge on their website, and all of their products are vegan, except for their lip oil, which contains organic beeswax from humanely sourced regenerative beekeeping. All of their products are also Leaping Bunny certified, cruelty-free, with no animal testing, and made in the USA, with the exception of wooden pencils and accessories, which are made in American-owned factories in Germany with extremely high social, ethical, and environmental standards. And they use sustainable and environmentally conscious packaging with no plastic for primary packaging. Their products are also incredible. They make, hands down, the best mascara I have ever tried. Their Golden Light Multi-Peptide Facial Serum will make your skin glow. They also have an incredible Daylight Facial Cream and Nightlight Facial Cream, and an awesome makeup cleansing balm. You can check out their foundation as well and their incredible sunscreen products. If you want safe sunscreen, you've got to try Crunchy. You can shop with me at crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. That's crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. And new customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off eligible orders. New customers with me will also receive a gift from me after your first purchase. So again, for the ultimate in safe skincare and beauty, go to crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon and use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 for 10% off, as well as a free gift from me. For all the latest discounts, specials, and announcements from me in the world of safe skincare and clean beauty, definitely get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. For all the latest text updates, just text skincare, one word, to 877-861-8318. That's the word skincare to 877-861-8318.
All right, so this next one is so interesting because it takes place on a United States military base in the Cold War in 1980. It's in the UK, so it's a military base for the US, but located at the RFA, whatever you want to call it, base in the UK. They call it Britain's Roswell, the complete story. But inside this facility, they were storing nuclear weapons that weren't supposed to be there. And that will come into play as we continue. So on December 26th, two American security policemen are standing at the east gate of the RFA Woodbridge, watching the lights descend into the darkness behind the Rendlesham Forest. What happens next, Mel, I think is going to blow your mind.
And so what year was this?
This is 1980, and it begins on the 24th and goes to the 26th of December. Basically 3 days of scary encounters. Our main characters here are Sergeant Jim Pendleton, Private John Burgess, and then the other main one is Lieutenant Colonel Halt, but there are 10 total witnesses, including the base commander. The base commander basically plays the bad guy who tells everyone to shut up. There are other witnesses outside of the military as well. Okay, I think actually I said the 24th, but it's the 26th. All right, so on the 26th of December, on night one at 3 a.m. in the morning, the witching hour, a security patrol vehicle passes the east gate when AC1, or Private Stephens, I'm going to call it A1C, rather, like blood sugar, which is basically a private, A1C Stephens and A1C Burn spotlights descending into the forest. Initially, they dismissed this as an aircraft navigation lights, but the movement pattern suggested a crash landing, so they decide to radio the base. Stevens radios Central. Central, this is Mobile Patrol. We've got lights in the forest. Looks like something went down. Central Control from J.D. Chandler. Roger, investigate report. 15 minutes later, Central, we need backup. There's something out there! Exclamation point. So he's like panicked at this moment. Chandler dispatches for Sergeant Peniston, who will be the commanding ranking officer at this point, and Burroughs to and another private Burroughs to investigate. So A1C Casbang also joins on the radio relay, and the men surrender their weapons per the UK jurisdiction requirements because the UK soldiers are coming. So Peniston goes out with these guys and he sees these lights in the woods. He notices that there is this bright blue light beneath this triangle-looking, glass-looking sort of vehicle. So imagine a triangle that is 3 meters or 10 feet at its base, and then comes to a mild point in the front, and then it is sort of three-dimensional. So it's about 6 feet high. And on the top is a bright red light, and it's kind of appears like it did a minor crash landing or just didn't care because there were a lot of broken branches and scorched trees along the sides of it. And it landed on like what you would consider your typical UFO landing gear of like three prongs of legs. So he is trying to radio back, but no one's really hearing him because he's in this sort of sound bubble. So as they approach it, everyone gets this uneasy feeling like static electricity is all through the air, as though the air itself is energized. And he just, I don't know if it was bravery or if he was entranced. He doesn't really explain why he did it. He doesn't have an explanation, but he walked up to the craft and he saw engraved in the front of the craft what looked to be like hieroglyphics or symbols of some kind. And he just couldn't help himself because this craft was so beautiful. It looked like obsidian glass. It had no rivets, no seams. It was completely smooth looking and completely smooth to the touch, but a little bit warm, he said. And then he ran his hands over the hieroglyphics, which felt like they were engraved into this hardened glass, like black glass looking material. When he did that, he got this bizarre download of information he couldn't quite understand at the time, but it was like this bizarre download that basically told him that they were from Earth in the future. And he freaked out, but while he was next to the UFO, he couldn't hear anything. No wind, no trees rustling, none of the people talking to him. It was like he was in a complete sound void, almost in another dimension, so to speak, which is kind of interesting because that happens in a lot of paranormal phenomena, including a lot of people suggest that when they interact with Bigfoot, same thing. They don't hear anything. The whole forest just goes quiet. No crickets, no animals, no nothing. He basically radios all this information back once he gets there, and he doesn't say anything about the download. He doesn't get really too deep into what happened while he was out there. But here's what the radio logs show, which is really interesting. So the witnesses reported a 20 to 30 minute clearing, meaning that they were cleared, but the radio log shows a 45 minute communication gap. So there's basically at least 20 minutes of missing time where they're not in communication with the tower, but they think they are, but they're not. And the tower's like, hey, you guys are supposed to be talking to us. Where, like, what happened? They don't know. So that was weird. So on December 27th, the next night, Peniston decides he's going to write down this download in his journal because it's driving him crazy. So he begins to start writing things down. Everyone else is like, look, it's Christmas. We got to catch up and work after Christmas, after holidays, but we do need to go back out there and examine it. So Stephen says to Central, we're going to go back out there and check things out to make sure that we, you know, get everything that we need to look for in the daylight. So they go back out there and they find some interesting things. They bring out flashlights. They bring out Geiger counters. They bring out some plaster of Paris, a whole bunch of stuff. And basically, they find that the area is 100 times more radioactive than it should be. So like the area where the craft had landed, the trees, the ground, you know, that immediate area is highly radioactive. So that kind of freaks them out. They also see the three areas where the little pod legs landed, and they take casts of those with the plaster of Paris. They do some recording about what they're observing and what they're seeing. And during that same time, a lot of the generators on the base start like dying, vehicles inexplicably not starting or not running properly, etc. So it gets kind of crazy. Then as they're doing this, you know, second sort of inspection, they hear animals in the barn like about a mile away, and they look over, and Lieutenant Colonel Halt sees this red light and blue light and this craft approaching them at a rapid speed, and then another craft appears in the sky. This one is moon-shaped, and they're both approaching. So then the colonel decides to walk towards the two craft to see what's going on and point the Geiger counter at them, and he's picking up even more radiation from these craft now. All of a sudden, as he approaches them, they back up, and a laser-like light beam, kind of like you see in Star Trek when they, you know, Captain, we're being scanned for life signs, that sort of thing, right? It kind of zaps like right by their feet. It didn't touch them, but it came close enough to to scare them. And then that same laser beam, while the ship takes, to according to them, an instant course correction at 90 degrees and repositions itself directly over the military warehouse, housing, guess what?
What?
The nuclear weapons inside. And it scans it for over 10 minutes. Scanning, scanning, rescanning, keep scanning. It then takes off. So, you know, now you've got two different nights, two different encounters, physical evidence, time missing, radiation detection, etc. So Halt's quote was, strange, this is on his communication comms, strange flashing red lights, looks like it's winking at you, moving through the trees. 148, Halt. Here he comes from the south, coming towards us now. Now we're being observed. Appears to be a beam coming down to the ground. 222, Halt again. The object's gone south, still beaming down lights to the ground. Radar coordination. Halt contacts Eastern Radar, RAF Walton. Controllers reported nothing on scope. Of course, they never get it on radar. Then there was an alleged third landing. Now this included some witnesses, including Larry Warren, Adrian Buston. They claim a third major event occurred, but I'm not going to get to that because it's not really quite as relevant. But here's where it gets relevant. So after the encounter, the commander comes down to the base. The United States Air Force military gets involved, what they call the Office of Inspector General for the Air Force, or the OSI. So OSI agents come, take them to underground tunnels, all of the key people, not all of the witnesses, but all of the key people that like physically saw something or were in the presence of this. So that's Lieutenant Colonel Halt, Pendleton, the guy that touched it, and the other two privates that were with them for most of the time. They are taken down, and they believe that they were drugged, but they know that they were interrogated at length, and it basically told to shut up, that they didn't see anything. And so it's for the lieutenant colonel, given his rank, he doesn't get it quite as bad as the other guys do. So they don't drug him, but the other three guys report being drugged in some way, and definitely a very harsh interrogation from their own Air Force. So they were thinking they were coming to get like the details, like, so they were excited. And then it turns out that they were allegedly taken to an underground facility in an interrogation room involving these very harsh debriefings and very harsh interrogations under hypnosis and drug use. They think maybe truth serum, but they weren't really certain. And Burroughs, his testimony in 2013 was, they rewrote our statements. What I signed wasn't what I wrote. They said if we talked, quote, bullets are cheap. And then, so I'm going to rewind a little bit. Now what, I'm not sure if this was after, before, this was after. So Halt is pissed. He's a lieutenant colonel. He wants to know what's going on. His own government comes into the UK, doesn't do anything. So he's like, he's really miffed. So he writes a letter to the RAF, which is the Royal Air Force of the UK, and some other people. And it becomes known as the Halt Memo, H-A-L-T. And he writes this whole explanation to the RAF, expecting, like, you know, to do something. Now, he doesn't tell them everything because he doesn't want to think he's batshit Looney Tunes. But he does tell them the general gist that, hey, look, something definitely landed. We got these prints. We've got this. We've got things on record. We have things on tape. Basically giving them, like, the facts and keeping it to the strictly most benign way he could tell the story, but not make it so benign that they wouldn't have to, like, respond to it. So again, he's like expecting the same, like, all right, well, this happened on their country, so they're going to care. No, they don't care. So, Melanie, I am going to send you the picture of the response. You're going to love this. Oh my God. The actual letter itself, as well as the diagram that was drawn. Take a look at the last photo before you get to the other ones.
Take a look at the last photo first?
Yeah, because it's relevant to what we're talking about now. So remember, Halt went over his own government and wrote to the RAF. And this is their response. Want me to read it?
Which one? The
UFO sighting at Rendlesham Forests.
Okay, yes.
Okay. We are aware that on the 27th and 29th of December 1980, a number of personnel from the RAF Woodbridge saw strange lights in the vicinity of the base in Rendlesham Forest. Lieutenant Charles Halt, USA Deputy Base Commander, submitted a report on these events, which has passed to the Military Defense Department. As is the case with all UFO reports submitted to the MOD, Lieutenant Colonel Halt's report was examined carefully by the staff members for the Air Defense of the United Kingdom. No evidence was found of any threat to the defense of the United Kingdom, and no further investigation were carried out. No further information has come to light, which alters the view of the sightings of these lights and was of no defense significance. No identified object was seen on radar in the period in question, and there was no evidence of anything intruding the UK space and landed near the RAF Woodbridge. We are aware that there are a number of theories circulating about the UFO sightings. One theory was that it was seen that what was seen was a beam of Oxford Ness Lighthouse, which was distorting because the beam having been seen from through the trees.
With distortions being caused by the beam having been seen from through the trees. The Orford Ness Lighthouse.
Yes, thank you. There were also suggestions that fireball activity in the night explained some of the lights. In the absence of hard evidence, the MOD remains open-minded about these sightings. Basically, shut up, do what you're told.
Wow. It's the lighthouse that's been there the whole time, and tonight it looked a little crazy.
Been there for, you know, years. And these guys have been on the base for years or months. And yeah, they mistaken a lighthouse for a craft in the middle of the forest that burnt the trees and left radiation marks. Okay, sure. I mean, it's just like, you would at least expect them to come up with like a little bit better of a story, you know?
The photo you sent of the trees with the light, is that a reimagination or what is that?
Yeah, it's a reimagination. The diagram that was drawn by Peniston.
Okay. The diagram is actually what I thought it was going to look like. So I'm assuming there wouldn't be a comment on this because the weapons weren't supposed to be there anyways.
Bingo. You just hit the nail on the head. They had to cover this up no matter what because they didn't want anybody inspecting that place because there weren't supposed to be nuclear warheads there.
Yeah, well, because what I want to know is if, because earlier I was thinking about the different options for UFOs. So like they could be UFOs from other planets. They could be, you know, technology from another country, or they could be, I hadn't thought about that at the time, but they could be time travelers, you know, from the future. So I would be curious if like that beam did some, you know, like came back and like deactivated those weapons or something.
They don't deny or confirm that they even were there other than like in a 2022 FOIA request, right? Something like that. But at the time, they didn't, and even in the FOIA request, if it was there, it was redacted, they didn't say whether or not they were turned off or not. But there is two accounts that I'm going to tell you next, as soon as I wrap this one up, that in fact, that's exactly what happened. The UFOs came over the military installation and deactivated the entire military nuclear arsenal.
It's interesting that they said they were from the future. Maybe they were doing a little cleanup of certain incidences.
Well, I have to say one of my personal favorite theories is that the majority of the UFOs coming back are in fact us from the future, either trying to help us along. I had this one theory for a while that we are in a galactic war and that they are accelerating our technology so that the future accelerates so that in some timeline they can survive.
That's a fun theory.
Yeah. You can make a sci-fi movie out of that.
It just gets so confusing though, because how do you, you know, I don't understand how you go back and affect something and then it affects everything else. It's like the Mandela effect stuff that we were talking about.
Well, even if it didn't, right? It would affect a timeline. So it might not affect your timeline. Like you might go back to your future and it's still your future, but the future that's coming behind you, like in other words, there's thousands of different timelines and you're on a specific one. Even if you go back in the past, you can't change your timeline, but you've changed that timeline so that new Earth people will survive. So you might not be doing it for your timeline. You might be doing it for our timeline. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I mean that pretty much wraps up.
You know, maybe you would jump over to that new timeline then, because what's the point if you can't change your timeline? What's the point?
See, well, I'm saying I think there's some kind of weird paradoxical law about the timelines, and so I don't know for sure. You know, I'm not sophisticated enough with this time stuff.
You know what it's like? This is a good analogy. It's like when you're playing a computer game, and it's the one that's like a narrative-based game. I haven't played a cute computer game since I don't even know when, so I don't know how they are today. I know they're way different. But when I was growing up, it was like a plot that you were going through, because I always got like the plot-themed ones. And you would save your progress every so often, so that when you messed up, then you could go back before to where you saved and you could try again a different way. So maybe it's like that.
Yeah, that's an interesting theory.
It's like, whoop, messed up. Now let's go back to that point and fix it and then try again from there.
I'm going to dig in a little bit with this one, because not now, but sometime this month, because this whole time paradox thing always confuses me, whether or not you can change the timeline that you're in. If you come from timeline A back to here and change something in the past, does your timeline change or not? I think there's differing opinions on it, but I like your sort of like you're picking up where you left off idea. You're like saving it in the hard drive.
Yeah, like go back, try this, go back, try this.
So so to wrap this one up, so basically in the aftermath of this whole sort of thing, a few interesting things happen. So in 2010, well, a little before that, the guy that wrote that little journal that got the download, he wrote a whole bunch of zeros and ones down. What do you think? Now, this is 1980, remember?
It's that binary stuff.
Binary. Yeah, zeros and ones is how they code computers, right? Just zeros and ones, all binary. Well, not the coding, but it's all zeros and ones. That's how a computer operates. And so he writes all these zeros and ones down. He says in his own words, he couldn't get these zeros and ones out of his head. He was basically forced to write them down. He kept the journal. They never took the journal. So that was the one thing he still had. So because it was 1980 and computers were like just barely becoming a thing, he didn't really think anything of it. But in 2010, he's kind of curious and he wants to know what the heck this is. And they're doing a documentary on it. And they reach out to him. So he asks if they can help him decipher this bizarre piece of information that he has. So they do decipher it. And guess what they come up with? It says, basically, our eyes are your eyes. Well, it starts out with 666, the inspection of humanity. Our eyes are your eyes. And then it goes into a bunch of different locations on Earth, including the Great Pyramids of Giza, the Nazca Lines, and a few other choice historical spots. And the final thing it ends with is from the year 8100.
8100?
8100. So almost, 6,000 plus years in the future, which is good news. I guess we survived climate change.
Either something really bad happens in 8100, or that's when they got the technology to travel back.
Well, it sounds like the way that it's framed is that they were here checking on us and making sure that we don't kill ourselves. And that we're like, because it's basically, yeah, they're doing okay. We're going to continue as planned. We'll be back.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I'm starting, I'm just thinking if there's like one game or a million games being played.
Oh, with the Matrix theory?
But if there's a million games, I don't know why they would care about the other million games.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for you on that one. I got to think about that one too. Anyway, so that's really kind of how it ends with the 2010. There is a great documentary you can watch about Rendlesham Forest. I suggest you take a peek at it if you're interested, because it's one of the most interesting things. And all of the cover up stuff comes out. Here's a different quote that's slightly, I think, more accurate. Exploration of humanity continues for planetary advance. That's the quote.
Where'd you get the other translation?
So I typed it into Gemini real quick to see how they translated that quote. Exploration of humanity continues for planetary advance.
Zeros and ones.
No, I didn't type in the zeros and ones. I asked it what the zeros and ones were translated to. And then it goes to a list of coordinates. This is also from Gemini, like the Great Pyramid of Giza, the Nazca Lines, Peru, and the mythical sunken island of High Brazil off the coast of Ireland. It ended with the origin year of 8100.
Wow. Okay.
So the only controversy about the zeros and ones is not what it's translated to, but rather whether he created it in 1980 or post 1980, right? Which, you know, I could see that's a legitimate criticism, but still, that's, you know, it's not like the guy got rich doing that, writing zeros and ones in his spiral notebook. Now John Burroughs also had some serious, this is where it gets really, the cover gets really nasty. He had some serious health problems, the kind which would be attributed to high radiation dosages, including the complete degradation of his heart valve. And when he went to go to the Veterans Affairs to have his injuries recognized as a service-related injury, they first said, "You never even worked here, or you never were even enlisted." He's like, "What?" So he has to hire an attorney, and then they give him his medical records, but they only give him his medical records redacted with all of the stuff that they don't want out there. So he got a redacted version of his medical records. It was just enough information for them to pay for the procedure. Like, yes, he did work here. Yes, the injury happened on this date from being in service. But, like, everything else was redacted. Isn't that nuts?
Yeah.
No, so, that's why, like, you'd say, well, did he make up the zeros and ones? I don't think so, because, like, look at this cover-up. Like, it's great. Like, they literally denied he was even there.
It's like me right now trying to prove my identity to the IRS. I'm like, here is me.
Now, the guy that came to shut this all down, the guy in command, Colonel Charles Conrad, said the entire thing was a prank that he orchestrated because he rigged his Jeep with lights and sent it into the forest. You're going to do a prank on a nuclear warhead base? And you think a Jeep, they're not going to recognize a Jeep with lights on it? I mean, it's preposterous.
A lot of commitment. Unless he's playing the long game.
The final thing, and then we are done with this case, is that the Plaster of Paris cast, all of Halt's tapes from the audio that he recorded, and the witness statements vanished. Just went missing. Or remain redacted and sealed. But the majority of the physical evidence is just missing.
But they say it's... Are they saying it never existed, or are they saying that it's missing?
The British Ministry of Defense has released its entire filing and incident, but many of the key documents remain redacted or conveniently missing. That's all it says.
Yep, sensing trends here.
I like that one because, you know, you've got just normal working military dudes during Christmas. They're not messing around 2 days after Christmas playing some kind of crazy-ass prank on a nuclear warhead base. And the details they have are way too specific. Then the radiation, then the denial of the guy's injuries, the whole, you know, interrogation, the whole sweeping the entire thing under the rug by both militaries. And Halt, like, to go around your own military and go to the RAF, like, that means you're so convicted in what you saw and how dangerous it could be. You're taking a big risk doing that. So I just don't buy anything that any of the cover-ups. And I mean, even today, like, people are still questioning what's being covered up and what's being told and what's the truth. And I thought after 2017, which, you know, is almost 10 years ago now, we'd be way past this point. But we're still kind of like, you know, oh, what are these drones in the air? Oh, we don't know what they are. Like, when are we going to get over? Like, when are they going to stop with this?
Thrilling announcement, friends. My EMF blocking product line is finally here, and I'm going to tell you how you can get 10% off. Did you know that EMFs are considered a type 2B carcinogen by the IARC? They are linked to so many health issues, including headaches, migraines, fatigue, and even potential fertility issues. Thankfully, there are a lot of ways to reduce your exposure, and one of the best ways is to not use Bluetooth AirPods. And also, do not put your phone by your head. In fact, did you know that if you look in your iPhone, go to the legal section, and then RF exposure, Apple literally suggests that you use hands-free options like speakerphone, headphones, or other similar accessories to reduce your exposure to EMFs. Yes, it says this in your iPhone. And here's the other thing. Even wired headphones, being digital, can conduct EMFs into your head. That's why I made Avalon X EMF-free air tubes. They're basically like your normal wired headphones, but they turn into analog closer to your ear, so it stops transmission of EMFs into your head. I'm launching with black ones and rose gold. You can use adapters to make them fit any phone. And the reason this launch took so long, we're talking actually years, is because I was so neurotic on getting good sound quality. I cannot even tell you how many different prototypes I tried, but we finally have them, and you can get them now. Go to AvalonXEMF.us and use the code Melanie Avalon to get 10% off. That's AvalonXEMF.us with the coupon code Melanie Avalon to get 10% off. That link will actually redirect to my partner's website at Shield Your Body, and that coupon code Melanie Avalon will get you 10% off site-wide for all of their EMF blocking products, including my air tubes. AvalonXEMF.us with the coupon code Melanie Avalon for 10% off.
So I promise you a few others. These are much quicker, but they are kind of interesting and critical to our storytelling here and sort of the theme we've got going on here. Military encounters that were either well witnessed and documented or flat out proven. So let's see. Would you like to take a guess when the very first military encounter happened? What year?
Ever? I'm horrible with dates. I don't even know when the military started.
All right. So Roswell was 47. The first sort of witnessed slash documented military encounter was January 7th, 1948. This happened in Kentucky, and it is known as the Mantle Incident.
Mantle, like M-A-N-T-L-E?
M-E-N, two L's, yes.
T-L-L-E?
T-E-L-L.
M-A-N-T-E-L-L. Incident. Okay.
It was a P-51D jet or plane. Captain Thomas F. Mantell pursued a large metal object reported near Goodman Field, climbing above 20,000 feet without an oxygen mask, and in the attempt to catch up to this object, ran out of air, passed out, and thus crashed, dying in the attempt. That was the first known death of any kind of interaction with UFOs. October 1st, 1948, USFA, F-51D, and this is known as the Gorman dogfight. Lieutenant Gorman engaged with a luminous sphere for 27 minutes. He and Fargo air traffic control tracked an erratic 90-degree turns and rapid climbs that the fighter could simply not match. After 27 minutes, he broke off visual. Could not see it, but called it an unexplained sign. The Blue Book evaluation sheets, basically like, yeah, nothing to see here. Just unexplained. That's all they said. But again, captured on radar, seen by a fighter pilot, chased for 27 minutes. Another famous, this is actually a pretty famous one. This is 1953, as a jet error comes in. This is United States Air Force with an F-89, otherwise known as a Scorpion jet. Over Lake Superior. This was known as the Kinross Intercept. The Scorpion scrambled on an unknown radar target. Ground scope showed that the fighter merged with the objects and then disappeared. So as the fighter approached this radar object that they requested he fly out and catch, his plane's radar signature merged with the unknown object. He disappeared. He nor the plane were ever recovered. Missing in action.
Yeah, that's scary.
Yeah. So like imagine watching the things merge and like he just vanishes. Comms go off. He's no plane, no crash, no, just gone. 1952 on multiple nights. This is right over Washington, D.C., by the way. So Andrews Air Force Base captures high-speed intruders F-94 crews reported bright lights that outran them by a substantial speed. The targets reappeared when the fighters left. So the fighters came out. Targets took off at like 10 times their speed. Fighters leave. The targets come back.
Scary.
Okay, 1957, Gulf Coast. Multi-sensors go off, yada yada. Planes go after it.
I don't find it. So they always talk about how the things are normally near the military bases, but isn't that where the radars are to see them? Like, wouldn't that make sense?
Yeah. So most of these, the majority of these are captured by military radar.
Like, cause it's kind of like, oh, they're always by a flashlight. It's like, yeah, cause that's the flashlight. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I know exactly what you're saying.
Because, like, I don't know, like, military bases, can they see everywhere beyond, like...
Today's current radar is pretty advanced, so we can see, like, pretty darn far into the skies. And we can see, you know, all types of different things. So, yes, for sure. All right, Melanie, so we come to the crescendo of this little epic journey with the military. And it will end with what we had mentioned earlier about nuclear facilities. So there have been at least three that were fairly confident given the evidence that have occurred. And we even have some for Russia. So this wasn't just in a United States thing. This happened in multiple countries. March 24th, 1967, Lieutenant Robert Salas and multiple security guards of radar operations in a declassified Air Force documents and sworn testimony stationed 60 feet underground monitoring 10 Minuteman intercontinental ballistic nuclear warheads and missiles. Security guards reported an orange-red pulsating UFO hovering over the facility. The object made an unusual controlled maneuverings at incredibly high speed, making 90-degree turns, and within 10 minutes of its appearance, all 10 nuclear missiles went offline simultaneously, an unprecedented event that had never occurred before. A similar incident at the base happened 8 days earlier at the same base. Within 6 months, 30 nuclear missiles were disabled by UFOs across multiple facilities, including Minot Air Force Base, in this time frame. Now, you want to hear the debunking?
Yeah, it was a weather balloon.
In 2025. So, now remember, this was 1967. In 2025, the Pentagon revealed that the incident was caused by a classified electronic magnetic pulse device test. So you went to your own nuclear facility 30 times. You turned off your own nuclear missiles?
I mean, maybe they were testing that.
In 1967, if they had that kind of capability in 1967, why would we even worry about having nuclear?
This is where my lack of military knowledge is and timelines is not helpful. Because I'm like, yeah, that makes sense.
But EMPs don't just, if you do an EMP, it doesn't just turn off like the missile arrays. Every electronic device in the whole area just shuts down.
Unless they were that's why they were testing this specific type.
I just don't buy that. They decided in 2025 to come out with this report on an EMP device. And if they had an EMP device that could do that, why would we be worried about nuclear war?
Yeah. The timelines of how they reveal information is just so weird. Kind of like what we talked about with the drones over, the recent ones where they're like, oh, we don't know what they are. We don't know. Oh yeah, they're ours.
Which we knew all along anyway. But what we still don't know is what were they doing there? Who owned them? Why were they there? And then months later, I was still getting them over my house. By the way, I need those videos because they disappeared off my phone when I lost my iCloud account. So first we had the Reynolds from Forest where they were scanning them. And now they've escalated to, turning them off, right? This happens again, this time in the Soviet Union. Same thing, multiple people within the Soviet Union and the KGB basically say, yeah, they flew over one of our nuclear facilities, turned off the weapons. Now, even if we were testing it ourselves, would we be crazy enough to take our secret little weapon in 1989 in the height of the Cold War and go turn off their nuclear weapons? I don't think so. That would seem like you're asking to get killed. KGB also says that they had an interaction with a military alien force and collected the bodies and wreckage of secret research facilities. So who knows about that one?
It's interesting that they even decide to comment on it.
They are obsessed with space and space stuff, so it's part of their culture.
No, like the government saying that it was this pulse thing.
Yeah, right. Like, why just let it go? But I think as the information age grows and so many people are aware of so many things and they're like, what's up with it? Like, a certain other piece of information that we were given recently that we knew was all complete horse crap. And you're like, why are you even bringing this up? If you're going to give us some complete ridiculous story, like, you're better off not saying anything, right? So, like, why now they decide they're going to come out and tell us in 2025 about how they had some secret EMP weapon, which, by the way, EMP weapons are still not commonly used in warfare. So just look, it's just weird. There was one more in Russia, but I can't find it. So I will leave it at that. But there were multiple USA missile interferences. And here's the scary part, Melanie. There was one time where they activated both the USSR's missiles and the United States missiles.
And that's like well known and established?
That is well established through witness testimony and redacted FOIA documents. But there is no like concrete report or article about it. So you have to piece together the witness statements and basically what you can piece together from what little bit of information you get from these FOIA requests. So turning them on is definitely not part of the EMP project. But the fact that they even comment on it, so now you know it happened, right? So right there, they have admitted that something happened at that base that turned off those nuclear missiles. Again, is that like their way of saying, yeah, there was something there?
Yeah, it's really interesting why, especially, I mean, ever since even like the government report about the UAPs and everything, it's like, why did they have this paradigm shift where they decided to start saying things are out there? Like, what's the agenda here?
I have a hypothesis. And my hypothesis is that we are getting very close to that kind of technology where drones will be able to do crazy maneuvering and crazy speeds. And we have hypersonic jets in development. And I think when they start flying and zipping through the skies, they want to have plausible deniability.
So they can say it's UFOs.
Yes. It's UAP. It's on us.
Yeah.
Which I don't have an issue with, because in the interest of national security, like, you don't want your enemies knowing your capability.
It actually, that works for both. Like, it could either be because we have our technology or because it's UFO, it's actual UFOs. And so they don't want everybody to freak out.
Yeah. And with everybody having cameras and everybody looking at the skies and the subject being top of mind, it works in both scenarios. Like, look, if a lot of UFOs come down, great. Like, we've at least kind of prepped people. If they see it, like, they're not going to freak out as much. And if it's us, then, well, we got our butts covered. So, yeah, it's kind of a win-win.
Isn't that the scene in what's the scene in Science when they go into the town and then the military guy is, like, talking about it, what it is?
I just watched it.
I think he says, or no, I'm trying to remember if he says that it's the alien sending, like, scouts.
It's not a military guy.
Yeah, because he's at the arm, because Joaquin Phoenix is, like, holding the pamphlet about, like, joining the...
Oh, yeah. He goes, you want to know what that is? Here's what he says. He says, you know what the first thing you do on an invasion is, son? No, sir. You send in a scout. You probe the enemy for weakness. You find out what their talents are, where their weak spots are, and then the mothership comes in.
Are you sure? I don't remember that quote.
No, I'm paraphrasing, but that was basically what he said. But the quote he did say, you know, the one line I'm pretty sure was, you want to know the first thing they do is, son? I think that was the quote. And then he says, they send in a scout to probe for weakness.
He definitely communicates that vibe. I don't think that was a direct quote, but
I'm going to get that direct quote, which reminds me, I read during this UFO research, I read about a UFO encounter with aliens in a southern home, in a southern like compound with like 20 people living at the house. They literally like attack the people in their house, climbing on the roof, just like in Signs. And they have claws, just like in Signs. And they blend into shit. Like, I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, I've got to watch it again. The one guy walks out of the house and these claws grab him by the shoulder. And his brother-in-law shoots through the roof of the porch to get this thing off of him. But every time they shoot them, it just sort of gets repelled. Like, they can't kill them. It's crazy. But yeah, it was basically like three or four claws. I can't remember if it was three or four, but like they had those like exact same claws on their hands, and they were scaly little goblin looking things. They were smaller than the ones in Signs, but they had the claws and they were lizard looking like goblin things. So my question for you, Melanie, as we wrap this up tonight is, are you closer to believing that there are aliens and that we are getting visited by them now, or has this not changed your opinion in either direction, or do you feel less likely?
Well, I always thought they were aliens from like day one, and I thought people were silly to be so unaccepting of this, all the stories, but I am more leaning towards it being also like government stuff or government stuff from the future. I could see how it could be like all the things.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of mixed things.
I mean, if there's like a galactic war in the future, then, you know, then
I tend to think there isn't one answer for this. I tend to think that there are multiple species, us coming back, other, you know, our own military. I think it's kind of all of it.
Yeah, literally nothing surprises me at all. I think the most convincing for it also being aliens, in addition to government's military stuff, is if like the Bob Lazar stuff, and like if it really, because he said, you know, they found that craft in like a
archaeologic dig.
Yeah, which it's like, okay, that's interesting. Like,
yeah, he also said something about the two forces of gravity that no one really picks up on, but I was listening to Eric Weinstein today. Do you know who he is?
Mm-hmm. One time, I have a story. One time, either he or Brett Weinstein looked at my story on Instagram. I don't know why. It was a moment.
That is a moment. Brett has a podcast called The Portal, and Eric is more like guy that goes on other podcasts.
They both go on Joe Rogan.
Yeah, but Eric's been on, I think, a few times, and I think, was it Dave, the other guy's name? Or no, Brett. Wait, they both have a podcast. Yeah, Eric does Dark Horse and Brett does The Portal, or vice versa. I might be getting them mixed up.
I actually found, I really wanted to book them for the show. And so I was trying, like either of them, honestly. And I was like trying to find contact information. And I found in a government document online, one of their emails. It was so random. And then I told them that in the email. That's how I found it. And I wanted to make it seem like, I don't know. I don't know if I came off as more crazy or less crazy.
I'm going with more crazy. Because I listened to him for 6 hours over the last like 3 days, because he did like a 4-hour podcast and a 3-hour podcast and another 2-hour podcast. And these weren't Joe Rogan. These were like other physics guys. So my brain was like melting trying to comprehend what they were saying. But I got maybe 10%, because they were just really in the deep physics stuff. But I like hearing his debate, and he's onto a theory that, which I've always believed, that the universe is not expanding, at least not in the way that they say that it is. And he has a whole explanation that I will not get into right now, because I will not do it justice. But he referenced Bob Lazar, and he said, listen, the reason... And the other guy starts laughing. He goes, see, you're already laughing. He goes, you can't just dismiss the guy. He might be crazy. He might have some issues of stability. But I saw his interview in 1989, and he brought up the weak and strong gravity, which, and then he went into this whole reason why that matters, and, you know, gave a very physics explanation for it in mathematical formulas. And I was like, damn. So he's like, you can't throw the baby out the bathwater. Like, yes, maybe Bob Lazar isn't all there. Maybe he's in a criminal. I don't know. But what I do know is he knew something about gravity that no one knew in 1989.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, I like listening to Eric, but I can't take him in huge quantities because he can tend to be a tad condescending. So I wish he would just tweak that a tad. But I do admire him, and I love what he's about, which is like, we have to make science available to everyone and not just like stick within these parameters that we've been stuck with for so long. We can't make any progress. And he goes into a whole explanation as to who and why, and it's really good.
Well, thank you. That was quite the journey. And this was just part one.
And that was just military.
Yeah, just military. I honestly, I bet there's hundreds of more things that have happened, but we're not hearing about them. Because it sounds like they make it really scary for you to...
Oh, yeah. There's hundreds of stories of Men in Black where people are terrified. And a lot of people in that community that jumped out of windows or didn't make it home or, you know, it seems like real clandestine sort of... If you get the wrong image or the wrong proof, you might not make it.
Yeah.
But there were another 20 military interactions, but, you know, a lot of them were like the ones we've already heard about, like the Tic Tac and the Go Fast. And so I didn't want to rehash a bunch of repetitive stuff. So I just went with sort of, you know, the main things. But to your point, there were at least 30 military encounters that had witnesses and or were on record officially just in the United States. And then there were a bunch in the USSR and a bunch in the UK and a bunch in Colombia. So it's pretty prevalent.
Well, thank you. That was really epic. And listeners, so I think we're going to air a different topic next week. And then after that, it will be part two of this for civilian encounters. I'm very excited for that one.
Yes. We'll give your brain a little breather on the UFOs. I know my brain needs a breather.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And again, Maisie, this week's winner of our Avalon X Magnesium 8, send a screenshot of your review to contact@mindblownshow.com. And we will send you that bottle and also send us your ideas for other episode topics. We would love to hear them. And yeah, I think that's all the things. Anything from you, Scott, before we go?
Just say that email address one more time.
contact@mindblownshow.com.
Perfect. Thank you. All right, everybody, please share an episode. If you love this one, please share it with your friends and family and write a review if you can. Thank you so much. We always appreciate that. It does wonders for us and means the world.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Scott. This was really, really epic. Thank you so much. I'm excited for part two.
Me too. Talk to you later, Mel.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Mind Blown podcast. Don't worry, your brain can store about 1 million gigabytes of data. That's enough memory to record continuous TV shows for over 300 years. That said, psychology suggests that your memory is actually just your memory of your last memory, leading to a process called memory distortion, where your memories change over time. If you're enjoying the show, remember to subscribe and write a brief review in Apple Podcasts, and definitely let us know what you find most mind-blowing.